life is like an open book, and as I glance back through the pages, I see the chances I often took, though I was never too courageous. Life's never easy all the time. The hills you climb often lead nowhere. Of ups and downs, I've had my share. That's what life is all about. I've known success, some mild acclaim, and thinking of it gives me pleasure. And I've had some stress, the scars remain, when Lady Luck gave me short measure. When things went wrong, I'd fake a smile, but that's my style, 'cause I've been around. And having been around, I've found that's what life is all about. It's been a joy, I can't deny, though some may think I took things lightly. But man and boy, I looked on high and never failed to thank him nightly. When I look back, I can't forget the friends I've met and the things they've done. I thank them all, it's been great fun. As for me, I have no doubt that's what life is all about. That's what life is all about.
It may seem strange to start thinking back in one's life with a song, but that song, That's What Life Is All About, was one of the last songs ever recorded by my idol, Bing Crosby. Quite an idol. As I tell my story, you'll probably guess why later on, but... That song, it almost put together my life too, in essence. I was born in Douglas on the Isle of Man, to me still one of the most beautiful places in the world. On the 22nd of February in 1920, just after the end of the First World War, and I was born in a place called James Street. It's still there. It's the first street as you come up the quayside in Douglas. And it consisted of two long blocks. Well, not very long. The street was only about 100 yards long. But on one side, there's four blocks of flats. That's on the right-hand side coming from the market. And on the left-hand side were three sets of blocks of flats. Each block of flats consisted of six houses or six flats. They were three stories high, and on the ground floor there was two on the second floor, and two on the top floor. And of course, when I was born, there was no gas light then. We had to use oil lamps. I think there was just gas in the hallway as you went in, if I remember right. But I often think back how we managed, or other families too, managed to survive and live in these flats. Going up from the ground floor to the first floor, there were two flights of stairs, and then two from the first floor up to the top floor. As you went off the little landing, you went into the house, into the flat. Immediately on the left-hand side was a kitchen. And what a kitchen. It was about 12 foot long at the very outside. And I would think no more than 5 to 6 foot in width. And immediately as he went into the door, the kitchen, through the door, immediately on your right-hand side was a wooden box with a wooden lid, a flap lid on top. And that was the coal box. Each week the coal man came up, lifted the lid, tipped his bag of coal in, and of course coal dust went everywhere. How those women survived looking after those places, heaven only knows. As I say, it was three people in there and you couldn't move. The sink was at the end, immediately under the window, which looked out over the backyard and the backs of the houses in the next street, which was Lord Street. And there, all the dishes had to be washed and the clothes had to be washed in there. Well, past the kitchen door was a bedroom door on your left-hand side. Not a very big one. And on the right-hand side, you went into the door, into the hallway, was a bedroom. And then the next door led you into the living room. So that was a kitchen, a living room, and two bedrooms. Now there was my father and mother, my two sisters and a brother, all living under these conditions. I can't remember where we slept. I slept with my father and mother, I know that. I think my brother had to sleep in the living room. Two sisters shared a room. And then the toilets were outside. As you came to the first landing on your way upstairs to the first upstairs floor, there was a door leading to an outlet. And as you walked through this door, immediately facing you were two toilets, one for each flat on each land on the landing. And so you had two toilets on the ground floor, immediately above them, two, and then one for the top floor. So that was six toilets in blocks of two on top of each other. And the doors didn't extend, cover the whole opening of the door. There was a gap of about a foot open at the bottom and about a foot open at the top. By Jove, when you went to the toilet in the wintertime, it was cold there because the wind used to whistle around, because they were open, they were built slightly off the main building. As you walked through the door, there was a little landing about 3 foot open each side where the weather howled round. Then immediately at the back of the ground floor flat was a yard, So the women there, when they'd done the washing, they used to take turns. One day one woman would have the clotheslines in the yard, and the next day another one, and that sort of thing. They were drafty places, but they're still standing, although in recent years, I believe, they had them all modernised. And now they are flats for elderly people. I believe they've made them quite comfortable now. How, heaven only knows. I have been told that where our kitchen was, that now is a modern bathroom. So I suppose they've done them reasonably well for elderly people to live in. But James Street, it was right adjacent to the quayside. At one end of James Street was the marketplace, and the other end was Ridgeway Street, on the corner of which was St. Matthew's Church, where our family went on Sundays. And it was quite an old church. Although, thinking back, it hadn't been built all that many years before I was born, but the original St. Matthew's Church was along where the marketplace is. And the marketplace was quite a centre of activity, especially on Saturdays. There was a general market. I remember a stall there. They sold carpets and mats and things. The people's name was Richardson's. But that was like a general store. And adjacent to that was the fish market, where there were fish stalls, and there was always a plentiful supply of real fresh fish in those days. And outside the market, on the pavement, fishermen had loads of fish, which they just lay on the pavement or the roadway and sold them directly to the public. You could buy whole big cods freshly caught that morning, lobsters. On the other side of the road was the meat market. That was where you got fresh Manx meat. And just in a tiny corner of the meat market, actually in James Street, was a tiny place. Heavens, it must have only been about 8 foot long and barely 3 foot wide. And that was a shop. It had a window which opened up, and this woman, she sold milk through this window. Mrs. Agendew, her name was, and she sold ice cream, homemade ice cream. There was just barely room for one person to stand in that shop, and she sold the milk from urns. You had to take a jug there, and she had like a metal scoop which she put into the urn and poured it, the milk, directly into your jug. Mary Agendew, that was her name. She was a typical Victorian woman with a high, she wore like a bluish shirt with a high, very high, stiff collar and a cravat in the front. I can picture her now. And she had two daughters who occasionally took over the shop. And it was open all sorts of hours. And then into James, from on the left-hand side of James Street, opposite Mrs. Agendew's shop, was a butcher's shop, John McKnight's. That's where my mother used to shop for her meat. And round the corner, leading from the quay up to Duke Street and eventually through onto Strand Street, was a short hill called Market Hill. And the first shop on the left-hand side from James Street was a grocer's shop, Dibbs the Grocer's. And they had all sorts of beautiful food there. Of course, it wasn't pre-packaged like it is at the present time. You went in for a pound of sugar. The sugar was in bags, and the The man behind the counter had a scoop and he poured it into a bag and weighed it on the scales in front of your eyes, then packaged it up for you. It was the same with everything. Tea, rice, sago, flour, everything. And butter was weighed too. It wasn't all pre-packaged, of course. And there were sides of bacon hanging from the ceiling, which when you wanted, you picked which sort of bacon you wanted, and he put it onto the machine and sliced it in front of your eyes. They also baked their own bread and buns, beautiful buns, sticky buns with cuttings in. And I remember as a child, they had a backyard behind the shop, and when the man done his bacon, he used to bring them out of the oven on trays, and he used to put them into this backyard. And I have to admit that on a number of occasions with some of the other boys and girls around there, we used to nip into the yard if there was no one about and steal a little cold bun. Well, they were big buns. And how they tasted fresh from the oven. The mind boggles when I think back of it. But they had a man with a horse and cart who used to deliver their groceries and bread. And you had to watch for this man coming. Mr. Q, his name was, K-E-W. And he had this immense Shire horse pulling this cart. Happy memories. On the next shop to Dibbs the grocer's was Conabears, a fruit shop. And then beyond that, on the next corner from the Market Hill into Lord Street, was a stationer's, Luthwaite's. And on the opposite side of this little Market Hill, the bottom shop, the first shop, was a chemist, Young's the chemist. And he was a real old man when I was a child. But people used to go there for, they couldn't afford to go to the doctor. They used to go to Mr. Young at the chemist and tell them what was wrong. And he used to make up medicine for them. If anybody got hurt, they took them to Mr. Young and he would patch them up, bandage them up. And he was quite a bit of a doctor, was Mr. Young. And next to that was a grocer's shop called Pegram's, or Pegram's, P-E-G-R-A-M-S. It was quite a little store. I think they were an English firm, actually. And then the next shop on the corner, on the right-hand side of Market Hill and Lord Street, was another chemist, Halton's, H-A-L-T-O-N-S, Halton's chemist. And round the corner from Mr. Young's chemist shop, there was an hotel or a public house. It's still there, the old Market Inn. And then the other side of the market, there's the Clarendon Hotel and the Douglas Hotel, the Albert Hotel, and the British Hotel to the right hand. Loads of hotels. So on a Saturday, they used to be quite busy around there. And every Saturday night, round about tea time, just after tea, the Salvation Army band would come. And there would be a chap holding a lantern to light the music up. And they would play music there and go around with a bag collecting money. And then the women used to go round all the pubs in that area selling the war cry, making funds for the Salvation Army. They were real happy days. And on the site where the bus station is now, the bus depot, was a mass of tiny streets and alleyways where they were that narrow that women used to stand at the door talking across to each other and they could practically touch hands. And I forget all the names, there were numerous names there. But I always remember one, Seneschal Lane. Get how it was spelt now. S-E-N-C-H-E-N-A-L or something like that. Because at one time there was a policeman, a very fat policeman in Douglas, and he was was pretty illiterate, apparently. Or so the story goes. I've heard the story told many times, where a tradesman's horse dropped dead, a pony rather, dropped dead in Seneschal Lane. And this policeman, he couldn't spell Seneschal Lane, so he put the pony over his shoulder and dragged it until he came to Fort Street, because he could spell Fort, F-O-R-T. That was the tale, but I've heard it told many times. But it was amazing, these passageways. You could get lost down there. And quite a few small public houses. They were no bigger than a small cottage. How they paid, heaven knows. And those little alleyways out onto the quay. And just by the Clarendon Hotel, there was a place called the Coffee House, which was like where you'd go in and have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea and sandwiches. And quite a lot of the fishermen would go in there and have breakfast or have a meal. The Coffee Palace, it was called. And in those days, the harbour was full of, in the summertime when the herring season was on, was absolutely full of small fishing boats and trawlers. You could practically walk from one side of the harbour to the other, crossing from one ship to another, over the decks and on the next ship. You could practically get across the harbour, and there wouldn't be a berth to spare. Every single berth in the harbour would be occupied. And there were women there who used to gut the herring. Most of them were from Scotland. They used to come for the herring season. And outside the Douglas and the Clarendon Hotel, there used to be stalls selling all sorts of goods and knick-knacks in the summertime when the holiday season was on, and a couple of oyster stalls used to sell oysters. People used to come up and buy oysters. The chap used to split them with a knife, open them up and put salt, pepper and vinegar on, and people used to eat them there. My father loved oysters. He used to also sell shrimps and mussels. So it was a place full of colour and character, which is all gone now. The harbour, in the winter time, used to be pretty empty, but the Isle of Man steam packet boats that weren't in service during the winter time, they used to come right up the top end of the harbour, up by the stone bridge, and they used to be tied up there for the winter, sometimes two abreast. You'd have about four Isle of Man steam packet ships up there tied up for the whole of the winter season. And at a place which they call the Tong, which stands out in the harbour, it's still there today at the Tong. And there was an engineering workshop there belonging to the Isle of Man steam packet, and paint store, and the men who were employed there used to do repairs to the ships for the summer, getting them ready for the following summer season. Well, that is where I was born. Now, something of my family. I must introduce you to my family. My father was born in Walsall in Staffordshire in 1876. His father had a stationer's business there, and I have an inkling he had a hotel there at one time. But my father's mother, she died giving birth to him, and his father remarried. Year or so after his wife's death, I believe. Now, her father had a sister who was a couple of years older than him, Winifred Adams. And my father married a woman who came from Saltney, that's near Chester. And apparently she had a boarding house where miners used to lodge with her, apparently. So I was told when I was a child, but she had been married for just a matter of hours. Apparently, she was married, she got married, and her and her husband went to catch a train to go on their honeymoon. And just as her husband stepped into the train, he collapsed and died of a heart attack. So she had only been married a few hours. So she became my father's stepmother and the only grandparent I ever saw. From what my father told me, she was an exceptionally good mother to him. He really liked her very, very much. But his father and his sister, they always blamed my father for his wife's death. That's what my mother told me, that his father never forgave him. However, that's who my father was. He came from Walsall. Now, my mother, she was born on the 5th of May, 1879, in Douglas. But her parents came from Bolton in Lancashire. And her father, apparently, was quite a character. He had married, he was born in 1835 in Bolton, a father, and he married a woman named Elizabeth Manwaring. She was also born in 1835 and belonged to Bolton. And they had five children. James, who was born in 1858, Martha, who was born in 1860, John Tuck, who was born in 1870, Jabez in 1872, all those children were born in Bolton. So I take it my mother's father and mother must have come to the Isle of Man to live shortly after them, because my mother was born in Douglas in 1879. But her father, he was only apparently 5'4", and as I say, they lived in Bolton. And when the American Civil War commenced, it affected the cotton trade in Lancashire and in all over Britain, I expect. And it made hard times. Now, my grandfather, he could read and write very good, I believe. But at that time, a lot of people couldn't even read or write. His wife, Elizabeth, she couldn't write. So, due to the days of depression then, when the people who worked in the mill were out of work, they used to gather together, and my grandfather used to get the paper, and he used to read to them about the Civil War, or what the cause of it, and how it was going on. And he was very, very against slavery, and he told these people. So the group that he used to read to, they all put pennies and halfpennies together and said to him, you should go to America and do something about it. So they made a collection and got enough money for him to sail from Liverpool to New York, which he did. And when he got to New York, after a few experiences, he joined the 69th Regiment, New York Volunteer Infantry. And he served right through till the end of the war. He was taken prisoner at one point, and he had some quite hair-raising experiences. He did write a short biography of his experiences during the Civil War, which I have read, and it's amazing what men put up with and how they survived it. Anyway, when the war finished, he was granted a pension, medical pension, of $12 a month for the rest of his life for impaired vision and disease of the heart, whatever that was. But he got that pension for the rest of his life. Now, when the war finished, he squandered what bit of money he had, and he didn't get home for about 4 years after the war finished. All told, he was away from his wife and two children in Bolton for about 10 years. He's quite an amazing character. Now then, as I say, my mother was born in the Isle of Man, and the rest of the children were all born before they came to the island. And apparently when their father came to the Isle of Man, he came and he had 2 and 6 pence in old money in his pocket, and he came to the Isle of Man selling Bibles. And that's how he come to live in the Isle of Man. So he must have made a bit of money, because he sent for the family, his wife and children came over. And then, from what my mother told me, he built some houses in Timbrel Street in Douglas, and he lived there. That's where my mother was born, in Timbrel Street in Douglas. And after that, he built some houses just off the promenade in a place called Mona's Drive. It's just a little short road off the promenade, just near the Palace Ballroom and the Castle Mona Hotel. And the one house he called Bolton Hall, I suppose in memory of his birthplace. And they lived there until he died. Now then, my father's father, when he came to the Isle of Man, he went into the boarding house trade, and he lived in the next little road off the promenade called Empress Drive. And both of my parents, that's my grandparents, had their money invested in a bank on the island, named Dumble's Bank. Now in 1900, Dumble's Bank collapsed, and many people on the island were ruined financially, including my father's father and my mother's mother. Her husband, James Pendlebury, had died 3 years before in 1897. And my father's father never got over it, and he died in 1904. So that was my grandparents. Now then, my own family, my mother and father, they had 5 children, I think it is. The eldest, my sister Winnie, was born in 1900. Then, between then and a couple of years after that, my mother had 2 children who died in infancy, Lawrence and Leslie. They were very, very young. One was only months old, I believe, and the other was about 18 months. The youngest one died, Lawrence, of meningitis. And the other boy, Leslie, he died of diphtheria, which was very prevalent in those days. And then my brother Eric, he was born in 1907. And my sister Connie was born in 1914. than I came along in 1920. So that was my family. And as I've said, how we all managed to survive in that flat in James Street, heaven only knows. But that was my family, and I must admit, looking back, I had a very extremely happy childhood. My family were very close and happy. My father, he worked as a docker at the Isle of Man steam packet, where the warehouse was just by the swing bridge across the Douglas Harbour. And as a child, I used to go from school every day. I used to go down to the Isle of Man steam packet warehouse, and I used to sit on a packing case there and watch me father and his mates all unloading the boats. And I used to wait there until he finished work, and then used to walk home with him. And I got to know all of the men. There were some quite characters there. I always remember one. How he come to get the nickname, I don't know. They called him Harry the Yank. Harry the Yank. Whether he'd been in America for any length of time, I don't know. And there was a big coloured man. They called him Francis the Nigger. Everybody called him that. He used to pick me up and carry me walking along the quay. Oh, and Waller Morrison. Waller. How did he got the nickname Waller? I don't know. But I got to know all these men and loved them all. And I got to know quite a lot of the fishermen. They'd be sitting on the quayside by the boats while the boats were floating in the harbour, and they all knew me too. It was a wonderful place to live. Everybody knew everybody, and everybody passed the time of day and cracked a joke. I always remember one fisherman, his name was Lee. Nice to sit there. I'd only be perhaps five. And he used to say to me, "What are you going to be when you grow up, young Adams?" And I used to say, "I want to be a sailor, like my father." And he says, "Oh, aye," he says, "it's a wonderful life." And he says, "If you're going to go to sea, never learn to swim." And I was all full of ears and thought, "That's amazing. Why?" I asked. He said, "Well, if you're on a ship, you're way out at sea and the ship sinks," he said, "if you can swim," he said, "you'll keep on swimming. And you'll swim and swim and swim until you exhaust yourself and you can't swim anymore, and then you'll drown." He said, "But if you can't swim, when the ship sinks, you'll grab hold of something, a bit of wood or something, and you'll hang on for grim death, and you'll be saved that way." And strange, when my turn come to go away to sea in wartime, in the 1940s, I found that very true. I've seen that happen on quite a few occasions, how true it was. But as I say, I got to know all these big characters, and it was a real happy childhood. Just round the back of the steam packet buildings there, there was a little stony beach between the Victoria Pier and the old pier. It's called the King Edward Pier since the 1930s, but in my early childhood, they used to call it the Red Pier. It had like a little lighthouse on the end. But between those two piers, there was a little stony beach. My sister Connie used to take me down there to play. We used to go and sit down there and have a paddle in the water. It was no sand, or what sand that was there was very negligible. I think they called it the Circus Beach because apparently years and years before that, on the site of the old steam packet buildings, there had been a circus. But and women used to come down there in the summer, this time this was, on the sunny afternoons, and they used to bring their sheets and counterpanes, what have you, and pillowcases, and they used to stretch them out on the stones and peg them down with a few stones to stop them blowing away. And they used to put them there to dry and bleach. There was always the few women down there with their sheets, etc., laid out there. And there are some like concrete pillars underneath the Victoria Pier. We used to go walking out on this, on these concrete pylons, to see who dared go the furthest out. The things we used to get up to in those days. Of course, there were all the old children's games then. Hopscotch, kick the can, skipping ropes, tops. Happy days. Happy days. I recall, too, playing around by James Street. There was a street that used to be called Big Well Street. That was, today it is called Lord Street, and there are council flats on both sides, just past Hanover Street School, running adjacent to the harbour. Well, when I was very young at that time, all the old houses, it must have been part of Old Douglas, had all been knocked down. The buildings had been demolished. And I was up there playing with some of the other boys from James Street, and I fell onto a piece of old rusty corrugated iron and cut my knee. Terrible cut on me knee. Got home and crying my head out. I must have only been about 5 at the time. My father rushed me up to the doctor. Stitched it up. But that was all old, part of Old Douglas then. Gradually they cleared it all, and they built these council flats and renamed it Lord Street, up, running right up to the railway station, the start of Peel Road. And down on the quayside, there was a brewery, Clinch's Brewery it was called. And when they were brewing, the smell, you could hear it. You could smell this coming right across from the quayside up. Some people didn't like it, but I used to like it. It was hard to describe the smell, but to me it was quite nice. And I remember my mother used to send me with a jug along the quay. Wasn't far to walk, only 100 yards or so. And used to go up the brewery and ask for a jug full of balm. I can't remember what it was. But my mother used it to make homemade herb beer. She had a crock, stone crock. Used to make this herb beer in it. People wouldn't be bothered with that sort of thing nowadays. Now, my father, he loved entertainment. And the cinemas were just starting then, of course. Just coming into their right. And he used to go on a Sunday night. And the first, there was only one show of film on a Sunday night. The rest of the week, there were two houses at 6:30 and 8:30. So my father used to go to the cinema on a Sunday night, the first house on a Monday night, and the first house on a Thursday night. And he took me with him. Remember, I'd only be about 4 or 5, and I had to go with him. He used to take me there, and I'd sit on his knee. On a Sunday night, religiously, every night, Sunday night, when we came home, my mother had made a beautiful meat and potato pie. One can still see those pies with a beautiful golden crust, ornamented on top with little leaves. And when she put the knife in to cut it, the smell, oh, the old saying, ah, bisto. Well, that was religious. Every Sunday night we had that, after we come home from the cinema at about 10:15. Then on a Monday night he'd take me to the first house, bring me home, and then he used to go across to the British Hotel to have a drink. The same on a Thursday night. Now, the people who owned the British Hotel at that time, their name was McCartan, and they had a son who was the same age as me. So we became quite friendly, and my father used to take me to the hotel, and I'd go upstairs to the private accommodation upstairs and play with Charlie McCartan. He was lost during the evacuation of Dunkirk on one of the Isle of Man steam packet boats. Poor Charlie. But he was a good friend. And this was all part of growing up there. Another time I remember, it was the day before the Sunday school picnic. I used to go to St. Matthew's Church Sunday school. And my father told me I wasn't to go out to play. But after nagging my mother, she said, well, go out, just down, don't go outside the lobby. That's the entrance to the ground floor of the flats. Don't go outside the lobby. You can't go in the street and play. I said I was going to play with Reggie Klukas, who lived in the flat underneath. Gosh, you can remember, when you start thinking as I am now, how the mind goes back. The Klukases, Reggie Klukas, they lived in one flat underneath us. On the other flat facing them was a family called the Balls.